Please help me welcome Pete F., our main speaker tonight.
Hi, everybody. I'm Pete. I'm an alcoholic. It's so good to be here. Thank you, Lee, for the invitation. Thank you to this beautiful group. And I have a sobriety date, November 16th, 1991. So I'm super duper grateful. Ellie, I want to thank you for your talk. That was rock and roll. Keep going. And congratulations to the two-year people and anybody that, you know, 1 year, everybody here that's celebrating a birthday. I also want to thank my wife for coming up, my beautiful Sharon, who I, 6 years ago tomorrow, August 2nd, 2020, I reached out to her on Zoom during the pandemic, and she answered. Like, I took a Hail Mary shot at it, and she was speaking at a Zoom meeting. Sharon has spoken a lot, and that was a long story of how we had become connected. I heard her speak in 1995 at the San Diego International Convention over the years, and then here we were in a meeting with about 25 people on August 2nd, 2020. And I just asked her how she was doing. And that's not something a guy like me would normally know how to do. And we started a little conversation a couple months later. That led to a longer conversation. We got married 2 years ago on the shores of Maui. Let's clap that up. Because, you know, what's funny about this is that I'm a guy that probably shouldn't be married. And you're going to hear this story. And especially last week, Sharon and I were down in Atlanta, Georgia. She was a main speaker at the Atlanta Roundup. And I was asked to participate on a relationship, cultivating personal relationships panel with her and Lee's sponsor, Bob D. And I'm going, oh my goodness, what do they want me on this thing for? All the mistakes that I have made well into sobriety. We're not talking about mistakes I made while I was drinking. We're talking about mistakes. So, you know, holy moly, and that was such a good time. But the kicker of that, and I'll share some of those mistakes, was that I got to meet my sponsor, who lives in Athens, Georgia. Now, you're probably thinking, I live in Los Angeles, and my sponsor lives in Georgia, and he's a guy I knew in Bozeman, Montana. Hang with me. I know there's not a map up here, but I'm going to take you guys on a little bit of a tour of the U.S., maybe even a little of the world. I have lived all over the world. I've had some experiences here. And I met that man, or re-met that man, God, by divine appointment, in 2020, May of 2020, when I was 27 years sober and dying of alcoholism in a way I never thought I could possibly die. I was desperate. I was living a double life, maybe a triple life, maybe a quadruple life. I was just living all over the place, and I was really hurting. And there was a set of circumstances that brought me back into him, into his orbit. And I got into the big book, and I got into the steps, and the questions he asked me were, how is your relationship with your parents? And it was bad. And how is your relationship with God? And that was even worse, if you can believe it. And I didn't have one. And so, there we started in 2020. I'll get into, obviously, I'm 27 years sober when this happens, and this man, I hadn't seen him in the flesh since 2013 until we met last week. And so you can imagine a lot of life has happened. Every week over FaceTime, we had met, and we had, you know, going into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it was more than just going into the book. It was more of an experience that led to a relationship with a higher power. It led to new relationships with my parents. It led to making amends that I had not made, that were on that eighth and ninth step that had not been made. The IRS hadn't been paid for years, and I had to pay that thing off. And I had to start becoming a son to my mom and dad. And Dan said, before it gets too late. And what did he mean by that? Is he meant these parents of mine had stood by my side. They had stood by a lot. They stood by my act of alcoholism, which I grew up in Fairfax, Virginia. There's another location, Washington, D.C. I grew up in this suburban town that I could not wait to escape. You know, and a lot of people probably want to escape their home area because it's like, get me out of here, right? I want to see something new. I want to experience something new. I have always been a runner until relatively recently, you know, meeting Sharon, getting grounded in the Pacific Group, getting grounded in some other meetings in the Los Angeles area, landing and staying, even when it gets uncomfortable. We've got the ultimate contrary action to feeling uncomfortable, and that's to stay, and that's to go through it. I don't know how to go through anything. Are you kidding me? Back in those days, I just felt, you know, I grew up in the home pretty much like Ellie's. You know, I was supposed to thrive too, except my sister got the thrive gene and I got the clown gene, and I was ready to do that. And I was always feeling like I wasn't enough to her. She was the doctor, oncologist in training, and I was the guy that just, you know, she was the younger sister that acted like 6 years older than me. She had read every book, she was reading, she was doing all this stuff. You know, and she played the violin in the school orchestra, and I was the guy that quit the piano lessons when it got tough. I was the guy that was afraid to play baseball and strike out in front of my dad watching, so I had to quit. I'm a quitter. When it gets hard, and man, I tell you, thank God for Dan as a sponsor right now. He won't let me quit when I want to quit, when I want to quit that job, until it was time to leave in God's time, not in my time. That's what we get to learn here. That's the, how does Alcoholics Anonymous work? It works with beautiful sponsorship. It works with a direction that puts me in a conscious contact with a higher power. Those two things together. My higher power back in the day, I didn't have. Now, I had friendly direction. My parents were great people. They had experiences of how to live life. They live life by, you know, you're going to get a job, you're going to go to college, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And so they had a structure. I just didn't like that structure. We grew up in a Jewish household. I didn't want to be Jewish. I didn't want to do any of that stuff. I had a lot of shame about that. I right before everything kind of went to, you know what, my grandfather, this is about 10, 11 years old, 1983. My grandfather had been in World War II. He's a veteran. And he was over it. He saw things that, you know, and did things that I'll probably never see. And he helped liberate the concentration camp, Dachau concentration camp there. And he showed me this picture, just him and me. I came to find out later that I was the only, of all my grand siblings, you know, my other, you know, my sister and a lot of other cousins, they didn't get a chance to see that picture, but he showed me. And I just bit my lip and I it went right to my gut. And as I have a want to do, I internalized it and made that about me, like it was my fault. And this is something that I had something to do with, and I felt a lot of embarrassment and a lot of shame. And I didn't really want to talk about it with anybody. And which is interesting, and here's a little segue, is in 2017, I'm in graduate school, living in China. I ended up in Prague, and through a relationship with a German person, German gal, I ended up in Dachau concentration camp, walking through the doors that my grandfather had seen many, many years before, as an extension of an amend that I had made to him in 1993. So this is some of the stuff that can absolutely happen here. But back in those days, you know, I had the only way I could take news like that was to somehow make it about me. I had no ability to see anything that was wider than that. And left to my own devices today, that's what you get. You get a selfish and self-centered guy who doesn't see much outside of my own little box. I don't see the bigger context and the bigger, you know, what sphere of love and compassion. And to treat that shame, to treat that embarrassment, to treat that restlessness, you know, our lovely book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent, and there was a beautiful treatment for that. And I called it God, and that was alcohol. Alcohol for me was God. It did something for me, and I loved it. I loved every drop I took, and I paid consequences right away. Kind of like you were talking about, Ellie, I had some consequences that came my way. DUIs came. I drank and drove. I blacked out. I did stuff when I put alcohol in my system that I never thought I could do because I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. I didn't have that example. I didn't see it. But I always wanted to be a drunk. My hero, Bill Wilson, talks about his heroes as being, you know, stock market people, you know, the rich guys. My heroes were sports heroes. And I love reading books about their escapades. And I'm like, I want escapades like that. I'm not enough, right? So to treat that not enoughism, right? That's that hole in the soul, that malady, that spiritual malady, alcohol filled it. And right from the beginning, I was dealing with taking that morning drink, losing control of my bodily functions, doing stuff, wet in the bed, you know, other stuff that I won't say in the church. You know, you can talk to me later afterward if you want to hear more about some of those details. Amends that I made and still am making, you know, for stuff like that. And alcohol, despite the consequences, I loved it. Because it did something for me. It allowed me to be, allowed me to chill, allowed me to relax. It allowed me to quiet my head down. I didn't realize that a lot of alcoholics that I know, you know, have a head that moves a million miles an hour. Anybody have a head like that? Boom. I still have a head like that. I have a head that moves. And that's you know, welcome to the club, right? I mean, having a head that moves like that, I'm realizing is normal. You know, it's the normalcy of living a spiritual life is realizing and becoming aware of that. Not trying to be perfect, because Lord knows if you demanded perfection, I would not be here right now. Somebody else would be up here sharing. It wouldn't be me, because my whole story up until this second is living, making mistakes and growing through them, sharing them with others. And having something magical that happens as a result of that. But alcohol was magic. It was something, you know, like I said, I drank and drove. I drove drunk on people's lawns in my neighborhood. I drove drunk under my mom's best friend's lawns and whisked right by telephone poles. And, you know, and I thought I was like, this is great. I would wake up the next morning, cops would be in the neighborhood, and I would just feel like that sense of doom, but also that sense of, I got him. You know, nope, you know, I'm going to win. You know, I'm winning the war, right? And I got arrested 5 times in there. Once fake ID, you know, public, you know, stop urinating in public and doing those sorts of things. And each time got a little bit worse. Now, right before I had my DUI, there was an episode, May of 1991, where my mom, I just came back from college. I went to college. Here's another place, Penn State University. Huge, huge college, football. We were talking football. I went there for football. I was a sports writer. I went there to be a sports writer, and that was my dream job. And I actually got to do that in sobriety. So I love sports, love talking football. Sharon and I talk football. She warned me that we have a great time watching football games together, analyzing it and pulling it apart. And that was one of the things that's why I went there. And I got drunk right before my first day of classes. You know, I was on probation right away, you know, and I was just skating through. I get through that first year and I had to go back and live with my parents. You know, by this time, my parents, our relationship was strained. And it was really strained, and it had been strained. Because my parents had that structure, right? They had their way of life. They had the direction that they had. I mean, they had friendly direction. As Sharon, you know, and a lot of other speakers talk about, Clancy talked about, they had it. I didn't want their friendly direction. I rebelled against every bit of it. They said, do this. I went that way. You know, they said, you know, be good and help others. And I said, well, I'm going to do what I want because that's what I do. They said, don't break the law. Well, I became a teenage juvenile delinquent, and I love breaking windows and I love stealing things. And I broke, you know, if you want a long 9-step list, and it is, you do stuff like that. And that was my first run of amends, was, you know, cleaning up the mess, cleaning up the tornado, cleaning up the wreckage. And I said first round because I had to make amends a little bit later on, and a lot later on, as, you know, I'll share with you some of the stunts I was pulling, you know, later on in sobriety that was causing just as much harm with time as I was causing back in the day when I'm, you know, ripping and roaring, and I had no idea what was going on with me. All I know is I love the attention. And if anybody said, Pete, do this, I did it. Throw the egg, I threw the egg. Throw the bottle rocket in the librarian's door, I threw the bottle rocket in the librarian's door. Cause the fire, I caused the fire. Yell this, yell that. I was in the principal's office all the time. One time, I got pulled out of chemistry class twice in the same hour for breaking windows at my junior high school and also getting kicked out of a basketball game for stuff that, again, I'm not going to say here. Within the same hour, my chemistry teacher, Mr. Bonnet, is looking at me like, what is going on with you? And I get there, and the detectives are sitting there right in the office, and they say, we have a 98% success rate. We're going to bust your case right now. And of course, you say that to a guy like me, and I grew up with lawyers, and I grew up with judges, and I grew up with quick responses. You needed to be quick in my family. You still do. My dad is a retired lawyer, but boy, he still can be one. Poor Sharon got interrogated when we met, and she passed with flying colors, which, you know, I'm not surprised. But boy, I was, you know, I knew I needed to be quick-witted with these cops, and I was quick-witted with them. And I said, I'm gonna beat this. They are not gonna bust me. And there was another person involved that was implicated. And so they tried to press me. They tried to get me to admit to the crime, and I never admitted to this crime. They came back and did it again. My parents got involved. I, of course, lied through my teeth. The lies are building and compounding like compound interest. The lies are just mounting and mounting. And it's getting crazy, right? You know, my problems are piling up. And I have no way of getting out of this stuff. I just knew that I wasn't going to tell the truth. And of course, then the cops let it go. And I thought, well, I got him. I got him. And that's that weird. Anybody have a... Boy, if I start doing that today, I got him. Oh, look out. Because that means I'm running on complete self-will. I'm running the show. I didn't have him. I didn't have him. Of course, you know, I'm jumping ahead, but 5 years of sobriety, I have a sponsor. I live in Bozeman, Montana, and we end up getting to that 9-step list. And the amend, everybody probably has an amend that if you don't make, you're going to get drunk. This was that amend at that time. Later, it's become amends to my family, amends to, you know, the IRS and stuff like that, that if I didn't make those, I was going to get drunk. But this, at this time in 1995, I had a sponsor, and he's looking at this. You know, we'd gone through the steps, and he's looking, oh, I don't know how to handle this one. You know, and then he brought it to his sponsor. And I didn't really know his sponsor was going to then take it to Clancy. His sponsor was Clancy in L.A., And I think the results were, good luck, kid, as you go back to speak to that superintendent. Good luck. So I got 1995. I'm making one of those amends trips. And these, I know I'm jumping ahead, but we'll get back to it. And I'm in a suit like this. I'm sweating. You know, and there was another person involved, and this whole thing would have been done differently. Thankfully, that other person never got implicated. I had written them a letter, and they welcomed me into the office, Superintendent Spillane in Fairfax County. And, you know, they remembered the case. They had the file. They opened it up, and I went, oh, my God. And they said, well, the statute of limitations has run out. I didn't say I got him. I said, well, you know, I was fortunate. But he looked at me, and he knew why I was there. He knew that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, needing to clean up the past. And the superintendent's assistant, Mary Ann, was right there as well. And she's taking notes, and I'm sweating. And they go, well, let's come up with a plan. And I wasn't me. He said this. The superintendent, let's come up with a plan for you to write back a check, $100 a month, and we'll pay off these windows. And I probably should still be writing checks because I broke the windows twice. As soon as they put them back in, I broke them out again. It was crazy. That's why the cops were after me. It was in the middle of winter in 1989. The carnage that I caused and the harm to the principals and the students was immense. It's interesting, I'm a school teacher today. And I had been through an incident like this in my old school where there was an act of vandalism 2 years ago. And the way I got through that, rather than complaining, I did my fair share of complaining, was understanding that this is what it feels like to be on the receiving end of a complete act of vandalism. This is what it feels like to be inconvenienced and moved around. And I had to experience that 35 years after the fact. and what it was like to really rub out the record. Because that's what we get a chance to do here. This is about rubbing out the record. At that time, the money was sufficient, and I just had to save. I was given advice, please no praise for this. This has to be anonymous. Because they created a scholarship fund that I donated the money to, and that's what happened. But when I left the office, I thought I was done. I was, you know, again, I was 2.5 years sober, 24 years old at that time. And I walk out, and Marianne, who's sitting there, goes, can I talk with you, Pete? And I thought, oh, no, I thought I was out the door. And she goes, my son just got his second DUI, and I think he might be an alcoholic. Can you come into my office and share with me your story? How did you come into Alcoholics Anonymous? And so there I was, sharing a story, not to, kind of like this, maybe a little bit different, you know, trying to explain what some of those, you know, what are the symptoms of alcoholism? What do we have here? What's the problem? What's the problem? And then she felt a little bit more at ease. And she said, when I finished, we finished, she go, can you please come back? How does that happen? Where the carnage of the windows, the cops, Officer Schmaiman, Officer Cleveland, those are the two, and I had to go see them to clean that up, and they were like, oh, you got one on us, Pete. But, you know, when I went to go talk to them, how does it happen when something crazy like that becomes repurposed or reshaped, put it into the sphere of love? You know, the love of help, the love of service, the love of kindness that is going to be something that's helpful and useful. And that, I could not believe it. I walked out of that office feeling, I was expecting to run away, get the car and move out of there. But in a way, I felt a tremendous amount of gratitude. And it's a gratitude that I have continued to feel along the way. I got to share with her how I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came in on the heels of a drunk driving. And by this time in 1991, this is 4 years before I had made those amends, I'm a sports writer. I'm barely, you know, hanging on. I'm in a relationship. You know, I mean, I'm in one of those alcoholic relationships, to mention toxic relationships. This was like, save me, please. You know, those types of relationships, you know, where, you know, please help me. You know, it's something from the outside to take care of that, you know, disquiet that's on the inside. And I'm not okay. And just using people, I didn't realize that I have a pretty big habit of doing that, you know, kind of using people. And then as soon as it gets a little bit, you know, it gets old, you know, I don't want to be around and anymore. And you know, I don't want to run anymore. But boy, it became a pattern for me. And this whole thing was blown up with alcoholism. The night before I got that drunk driving arrest, right before, I wanted to tell you one more story because I think this is reflective in that same year because it implicates my parents, not implicates them. They were a part of this. I was in May of 1991, I come out of Penn State, and I had mentioned that, you know, I was there, I was in college, and I come through that first year and I had all those that craziness, and now I'm back at home and I'm in D.C. and I get drunk and I drink so much and I black out. I'm playing basketball and I land on my, you know, I land on the pavement. I don't have hands that break the fall because I'm so drunk. Next thing I know, I'm in the emergency room. My parents bring me, my buddies bring me to my door. My mom and dad answer. It's my mom's birthday. It's right around Memorial Day, 1991. And lo and behold, the words that come out of my mouth were bad words. Not gonna, you know, you can just imagine what they might be. And they have not seen me. You had, Ellie, you had talked about, you know, your relatives saw you in a rough spot. And my parents saw me in a tremendous spot. That night, my face was swollen. It was bloody. I was slurring. I was swearing. My dad in the emergency room had to hold me up to take the urine sample because nobody believed that all I had drank was alcohol. They thought it was, you know, that. What else could this guy be on? Because this is incredibly wild behavior. And his blood alcohol content is through the roof. And they didn't even want to tell me what it was because they knew a guy like me would brag about it. And they're right. I'd still be bragging about it. 3.9, yeah. You know, I mean, it was up there and they wouldn't tell me. And all I said was that, you know, I'm going to, I didn't have anything I could say at that time except use bad language toward the nurses. And my dad's holding me up and my buddy's there. And they take me to the next morning. I wake up, I come to from that, out of that blackout, out of that passout, and I see myself in the mirror, and I'm looking and my face is swollen, it's red, it's pussy. I cannot open my mouth. I cannot eat any food. I can barely talk. My dad, the lawyer, comes in. Again, he knows how to make a case. He knows how to try a case. He knows how to seal the deal. And he comes in, and this one is a tough one for him because, you know, he obviously, on the logical side of it, it's very clear that drinking's a problem, right? Although he had no idea drinking was my real solution. It was the solution to the real problem, which was me living sober. I didn't have to live sober. I didn't have any of that. But he says, Pete, you've got a problem. You got to control this. And I looked at him with, you know, I probably could have passed the polygraph test. I said, yeah, you're right. You're right. Absolutely right. It'll never happen again. I promise. I promise. Oh, I think we all know what that promise is like, you know, and that guarantee, right? You know, and especially when you're smart and blah, 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 blah. And you got a way with words and you know, to try to convince people. And I threw those words out there. And lo and behold, 3 days went by. And that restless, irritable, and discontent nature starts. I'm so swollen. I'm chewing food like a rabbit, drinking liquid carnation milkshakes. I'm just like going like this. And, you know, I'm working. This is summer, so I'm working patching potholes at Dulles International Airport. They're all looking at me. They're thinking I'm a warrior. And I'm, you know, like a fighter. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a warrior. My next door neighbor calls me Chewbacca. She said, you look like Chewbacca, Star Wars hero. And next thing I know, my mind, my ego latches onto that and goes, I'm a hero. So that I turn the mess into something that's going to work in my favor, because I'm not going to admit that I've got a problem here. I'm not going to admit the real truth. I'm certainly not conceding, surrendering nothing about any truth to my drinking, because why would I? I loved it, despite the consequences. If that's alcoholism kills, and it was taking me. It was taking me. And a couple days went by, and I get the call, and boom, I'm off to the races. That fear that had kept me sober for those 3 days was gone. Fear, I can't do it. The mind, the tape, can't do it. I've got an alcoholic mind. I now know that through the help of sponsorship, our wonderful book, our literature that talks about what an alcoholic mind is. That mind is, I will not remember that pain and suffering. I won't. I can't. I can't. Even though I want to, even though I might have initials after my name, degrees, whoop-de-doo, that's not going to help. Not going to help. And so then, as I started sharing you that story about the DUI, I got drunk at that, you know, with that relationship that's going to help me cure this. It's going to fix it, right? It's going to take care of that loneliness, because I was always lonely. I was always a daydreamer. I was always like wanting to be away from who I really was. Always had fantasies. Man, I watch that stuff today. I can still fantasize. That's probably why I'm a first grade teacher and a third grade teacher. I'm perfect. Those are my kids. Those are my students. We both fantasize together, and somehow some work gets done if we're lucky. How that came to be. That wasn't the game plan for me to be a grade school teacher, but you know, I'll get into that. Anyways, the DUI happens. I'm in the back of the cop car. You know, I drank so much that night. My girlfriend tried to take the keys away. And I, you know, argued with her, but, you know, she couldn't get them away from me. And like I said, I always drank and drove. I thought I was a good drinker and a driver. I hadn't gotten caught before. You know, I know how to turf a lawn. I know how to do this stuff. So I'm driving, I'm drunk, I'm on a state highway outside of, actually not too far from where I was working. And the cops, Officer Stone, and I remember names, and I for me, it's just maybe a nerdy thing to do. I love history and stuff like that, but I remember names because it was an important event. Officer Stone arrested me that night, and I believe an angel arrived. I had no idea when I got in the back of the police car that it was going to be part of a surrender. It was going to be a part of me just a little bit, because I don't surrender. Not today. I need help surrendering today. I need the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need you guys, men and women, sponsees. Boy, I need the sponsees to help me surrender, to help me see me. I need the spotlight put on me, the truth, not on what I think the truth is. But in the back of that car, you know, I for whatever reason, we were having a calm, civil conversation, even though I was drunker than drunk. Where does that come from? We talk Penn State football. Where does that come from? I was sane, and I was practically sober. He gets me in there. I get booked the next morning. Jennifer comes pick me up. Of course, I've got that pity. I've got that remorse. I've got that sense of, like, what's happened to me? You know, that nice, calm sense from the cop car is gone. That's why it surrenders, like a thin window. That window, when that window slams shut, boy, it can slam shut. And it slams shut. Next thing I know, it's like, why were you so late to pick me up? That's what I said to her. Next thing I know, I'm walking around. She's already talked to some member who grew up in an alcoholic home who basically told her, you better break up with this guy. And she did. But not before I took that drink right before. Because I got home and I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. I need a drink and I absolutely had to have it. The pain, the suffering, the humiliation, that was becoming the normal. That was normal. And I went on for about another month and a half. My parents found out about that DUI, and my good parents who had, again, they had that friendly direction, they had that structure, like, you know, education, lawyers, my grandfather was a judge. All these people, my uncle, professional musician, you know, they had made things of themselves. And I get that phone call from my mom and dad on November of 1991. They had found out about that DUI from a letter in the mail. At first, I get defensive. I don't know about you guys. When somebody opens your mail, my first thought is, what are you doing opening my mail? But something else happened when after I got through that initial wall. Again, another chink in the armor, the chink of surrender that was taking that wall away and was opening up to the level of truth that I need to grow here. And that truth was that something was desperately wrong in my life. I couldn't put the words to it. I didn't know what was happening. My mom gets on the phone and she says, and her and I have been fighting for years, fighting, not fist fighting, but just screaming at each other and antagonizing each other. And I always felt like she didn't understand me. That horrible war cry of, you don't understand me. I always felt like that. Wish I could, you know, tell you about something happened, you know, 8 years ago along those lines. But at that time, it was a mom talking to her son. It was sweet. It was something that she just shared, something that when I got off the phone, she said, I'm concerned. When I got off the phone, I knew I was done. Something else hung up the phone. The obsession to drink was removed. I don't know what. I didn't plan it on that phone call. I started it defensive. I started it as I would any other time. And the drink, the obsession to drink was removed. And I felt like, you know, Bill talks about that sense of victory. I had it. I had it. I thought, man, this is great. And then, as you might predict, or perhaps have experienced, maybe experienced, and take away alcohol from a guy like me without a solution, I'm in trouble. And I don't mean, I've got a mind that will kill me, but boy, if I don't change my actions, if my life doesn't change, my life is not going to go well. And unfortunately, neither is yours if you're in it with me. And so that little honeymoon, that little pink cloud, quickly evaporated. And I would say over that first 3 months before I actually ended up in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I was having a heart attack. I had anxiety attacks. I went and got an EKG. My mind was going a million miles an hour because I didn't have that alcohol as the solution. It wasn't the problem. I mean, it had become a problem. It had come back to burn me. But you take away the solution from me, boom, I'm done. And my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was in that town, State College, Pennsylvania, Penn State. And those men and women welcomed me. They took me as I was. And I was not somebody that was fit to share much at all. I had a lot of anger. And boy, did that anger start coming up. The fear started coming up. I had a nice chat with somebody, right? I think it was this gentleman right here. The fear, the anger, that's the stuff that blocks me from a higher power. I had no idea. You mentioned God to me. I ended up my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard the steps and I heard you guys talk about a higher power. And my first thought was, I really don't want anything to do with God. because I thought I had gotten away from that religion. I gotten away from my parents. I got away from that structure that I thought was oppressive and I didn't want to be around. And it was embarrassing and it was shameful. I didn't want to now have to do this. What do you mean have to do this? And so that was the dance. Those first couple of years, ended up in rehab. And what ended up happening, I can see now, many years later, that there was a beautiful, loving hand of God that had welcomed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, that had lifted that obsession. I go back to, I'm in school, I'm struggling to stay on as a sports writer at the Penn State paper. And then, I become a grocer in a grocery store, and that job might have saved my life. Because why would it save my life? It's like I needed to experience what it was like not to be a superstar. I thought I was a superstar sports writer. I thought I was a hero in my own mind. I thought I was living all that stuff that was in my head. And now, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor, but and now I'm in a grocery store, and there's nothing wrong with that. I love grocery stores. But I thought, oh my God, my mind made it a sense of embarrassment. I couldn't quite tell my parents about that, so I didn't speak to them for a year in early sobriety. Again, harm that was caused without drinking alcohol. My sponsor today says, I can be a raging alcoholic with a 0.0% blood alcohol content. And that was stone cold sober. And I've had a lot of experiences where that has happened to me, stone cold sober. Alcoholism is raging. And so I go through that rehab, I go through that job, and then a lady comes through my line and she shares with me that she had just come back from this place called Yellowstone National Park. Her daughter lived there and she was working as a snack bar operator. And she loved it so much because she wanted to be near her daughter. And this is 1993. My grandfather had just passed away. I had amends that I had made to him. I was kind of 1 foot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had started this process, but I really didn't feel comfortable. And it was nobody's fault. I had not conceded. I had not taken my whole seat. I had not done everything you shared. I still thought it was my parents' fault. And I still wanted to pin this on somebody else. I still was in the victim mode and I was still in the blame mode. And that's a groove that is a killer groove for an alcoholic of my type. And I've seen it of people that I'm around, especially guys I sponsor. They can, some people with some time can get into that victim mode. And all of a sudden they're blaming. And then their life is going down, as did mine. This lady comes through. I ask her, and she gives me a sheet that I had to fax. There was no phone call or faxing cell phone or whatever, no email at that time. So I send it in, and I end up going and taking this job. Somebody had said meetings in Bozeman, Montana were good, and so I end up going there on June 8th, 1994, another date that shifted and changed the purpose of my life. Because I can now see, why did that happen? She was an angel. The lady that came through my line was an angel that brought me to that meeting, that brought me to a sponsor who really helped me identify in our book with alcoholism, who was in that Clancy line, not that his line is better than anybody's line, in a group that was structured and fun and enthusiastic like this. I needed that kind of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was something different. It was attractive. It was the attraction that, I remember hearing some speakers, I won't name drop too much, but I heard a few. I think I mentioned one of them, Sharon. I heard her in 1995. I heard her in San Diego, and I was stalling on my amends at that time. I hadn't made many. I hadn't made that window of men that I shared. I'm sitting in that stadium and she's giving her talk. And I'm like not wanting to be with those 70,000 people in the Chargers stadium, Lee's a Chargers fan. I didn't want to be in Jack Murphy Stadium. I wanted to be anywhere but there. We had flown down from Montana, a huge contingent to San Diego. And I had moved there after I left that, after the park. And I was attracted, but I was still balking. I was still kind of shucking and jiving a little bit. And you could ask some people who were there and they would probably go, oh my God, that guy is crazy. But the only voice I did hear that night was Sharon's and Ben Clancy's the next day. Boy, I knew I needed to get busy. I needed to get busy cleaning up that past. What's ironic is that the man who's my sponsor today helped me clean up some crazy amends. One of those amends was to the cheerleaders of Clemson University. He was a professor at Clemson University, and he's in Bozeman, Montana. I went to a football game in 1989 at the University of Maryland, and I threw things, and I did a lot of mean things to those cheerleaders. Bad, you know, the kind of guy I was. And I thought about this, and Dan, at the time, said, I know, let me make a phone call to the athletic director at Clemson University. He makes a phone call, and next thing I know, he comes back to me and he goes, here's the number for the cheerleading coach. And if you've ever had to make a phone call like that, I got on my knees and I call her and she's crying. She didn't remember the exact incident, but she remembered others like it, because I mean, unfortunately, I've experienced that. She goes, my squad at Clemson University needs some financial assistance. We're going to a national tournament. Can you help us, please? Now, I'm a bellman at the Holiday Inn in Bozeman, Montana. I did not have a lot of free-floating cash. But what Dan told me to do, he wasn't my sponsor at the time. He said, why don't you get on your knees and ask God to write the check? And I did. I'm still not going to tell you how much I wrote for that check, because that would not make it God's check. I wrote it, and I sent it in the mail. And she hung up the phone, you know, that night after I said I would do that. A lot of times I had to make amends. One of the guys that was helpful in getting me to Bozeman, Montana, was a man by the name of Don Pritz from Aurora. He had flown up there. He had established a relationship. He was part of the reason why I was attracted to that. And again, I know I don't mean to name drop here, but this man's experience won me. It got me. His life had changed. He was living a life of purpose. He had a smile on his face about making amends. And he heard me talk about making amends. He said, Pete, I wish I could go cause harm right now so I could make amends with you right now. Boom. And he said, this is how you're going to clean that stuff up. You're going to knock on doors. You're going to do that. And so I did. I broke a lot of windows. And then some people who had cancer, I broke their window and had to clean it up. And I had to walk through that. Professional sports franchises. Of course, I made amends to my parents, my mom, my dad, and my sister, 1995. And the amend to my mom didn't go so well. I had written it out like a press release. I was a sports writer, and I wrote it, and I read it to her. We're in Charleston, South Carolina, another place. Sorry, taking all over the place. We're in Charleston, South Carolina. My dad was on his business trip. Actually, it was his 50th birthday, and my mom got a plane ticket. She didn't know she was getting me a plane ticket to make amends to her that was going to make her feel worse when she got back on the plane to go home. And that's exactly what happened. That's not what's supposed to happen here. I think amends are supposed to be freeing, hopefully, for the other person. It's supposed to be an experience that might be some forgiveness. That's not what happened. My mom, I read it to her. And she like got mad. I pulled off the scabs. I opened up the wounds. And I think we struggled for the next 25, 30 years in that relationship. Until things blew up in 2018, and then the pandemic, Dan comes into my life, and things are starting to come back together in a way that has been better than I could have possibly imagined. We'll end with some of that stuff in a few minutes. But I'm going through that. I made those amends. My dad was a lot different. He had worked with some people in Alcoholics Anonymous in his legal profession. So he sort of knew what I was doing, even though I read in the same press release. And he said some things that, what can I do? What else did I do? And, you know, I have to ask that question. He goes, yeah, there's a lot of things that you did that I didn't have on that list. All the vandalism. He knew about that. He knew about the windows. I told him. He knew about the driving and the drunks. How I treated my mom, his wife, very poorly. And so it began. Now, I wish I could say that those relations, they didn't. They didn't heal. I started to run from them even more. I was embarrassed. I was still ashamed. Even though I was going back to school, I was getting degrees. I'd become a sports writer again, an award-winning sports writer again. I thought, man, I'm getting there. I'm chasing my sister, who's now an oncologist. She's in medical school. She's, you know, getting married and having kids. And, you know, she's living that life. She's following the structure, mostly. She did, you know, there was a couple of times when I remember when she came out as gay, I went, yes, I finally got one on her. You know, she's gay. I'm going to, And I capitalized on that a little bit until sponsorship kind of intervened. That's what I am. I will use your worst stuff. Ugh. Thank God for the steps. The steps help us see the truth. They help a guy like me see the cold, hard truth. I have to see it, even if it doesn't make me look good. In fact, if it's making me look good, I need to run away from it. I need to see the truth, because the truth will set me free. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous have said that over and over and over again. The truth will set me free. The problem is that even when I was starting to get this, I was starting to pile up stuff. I was starting to pile up money, property, and prestige. And the spiritual experience that had happened when I lived in Bozeman, Montana, I started sponsoring people. I started going into jails and prisons. I started having a relationship with God, but I was using the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as a weapon. To see that whole truth was really hard to see. I started trying to share men's stories that were better than yours. I tried to be a star, superstar meditator that was better than you. And so I was getting sicker in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but using the lingo and the words in the book as a shield. It's probably why when I hear other people perhaps doing that, I get very sensitive and react and I start judging them, because that's exactly what I have been. I can spot that because I've got it, and I'm capable of doing it today. Hiding behind the book, hiding behind the words, trying to sound like I know what I'm talking about, but I'm dying on the vine. And I kept that going, went to graduate school. You know, I end up going through trips, and next thing I know now, you know, I'm studying Tibet and I'm studying Buddhism. I'm over there in India. I told you we'd go around the world. Now we're in India. I want to meet the Dalai Lama, and I did. I'm trying to become a super meditator, and almost blew my life up in 2004. And just everything was falling apart. I had a relationship that ended, and I ran, and I was running. And my sponsor at the time, and wasn't the guy that was there, Paul, but he was a man that said, Pete, you are basically unsponsorable right now. And that was 12 years of sobriety. I don't know if you have heard that you are unsponsorable, but if you get told that, you have one, you're going to either go this way or that way. Fortunately, when I got back to Bozeman, I listened to him and I took direction. And I started to work the steps. And I started to get back into it. My dad and I had an experience on that. We started experiencing some healing. He came to India and we visited together. We went around. We had some wild times. Incredible father-son bonding moments. I share with him a lot. Way more than the little letter that I read to him when I, made amends. It was being vulnerable and letting him in. And when we left, we were in Indira Gandhi International Airport. We both bowed to each other. And he said, Namaste. And I said, Namaste to him. And it was a beautiful moment that was a springboard to a new relationship, even though that has taken some time to develop. And I know I don't have a lot of time. But what I want to share is this. Even though that had happened, I still wasn't enough, and I needed to chase the PhD at a huge institution. So I was chasing another degree. Again, nothing wrong with education. But for me, I was dying with it. I was having panic attacks with it. I end up in institution after institution after institution, not jails, but in colleges. I'm running. I'm moving. It felt like I was in an institution because I felt so alone, and I didn't realize it. And again, I was living behind the book, what I knew, what I had done. I was using this stuff to keep you away from me rather than letting you know that I'm scared and I don't know what I'm doing here. So I'm in China. I'm having these wild experiences, and I never left Alcoholics Anonymous. But the year 2018 is a year that I need to share with you about real briefly. I got robbed in Vietnam in June. 2 months later, in September, I'm in a conference in Russia, academic conference, and I was a part of a drug bust. I was not taking drugs, but I was a part of a drug bust that was in a hotel because I was trying to live cheaply, and I had snuck into Russia because I wasn't telling anybody where I was. And they come in, and they send me to the curb in my underwear, and I've got my computer, and I begged to see my computer. It's a long story that I won't have, I know I'm, but let's just say I asked him for my money back after that happened. And so that happens. In the middle of that, I have a huge blow-up fight with my parents. And that's when I told them that they don't love me in the 27 years of sobriety. And I became that victim. I had mentioned at the outset that I had caused harm to them, and that harm came to roost with a horrible explosion in my mom and dad's kitchen in 2018. And then later that year, I took other unprincipled actions that I won't get into, but it was just, I was dying. And when I got to Dan, and Dan came to me in 2020, and he heard that fifth step, he said, "I cannot believe you stayed sober with the level of dishonesty that you had been living. You don't want to be a college professor. It's very clear. You lied to the IRS. You need to start cleaning that up. Your relations with your parents, we need to start rebuilding it from ground zero. You're not going to talk. You're going to act. You're going to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And Zoom was the best thing that I could do for that. It blew up for me. Sponsees showed up. I end up meeting Sharon. And I moved to Los Angeles. And I had no idea how was this PhD going to be repurposed. Because I thought I was supposed to be a college professor, superstar, to be with my sister, to be with my dad. I thought I needed that to fit in. And I did finish it. Thank God, through the sponsor's direction, you have to finish this dissertation. You're going to keep your phones off. You're going to actually cut down on your Zoom meetings, and you're going to finish that dissertation one day at a time. And I did. You're going to take the criticism. You're going to take the hit, and you're going to do it. But I had no idea when I got to L.A., and I'm in this big group, and they're all looking at me going, "Who is this guy with long hair and a beard in the Pacific group?" You know, Miss Sharon here is, you know, a rock star, Alcoholics Anonymous member. Who's this guy? I was full of fear, and I had to make some money. And so I thought I was going to make some money as an Uber Eats driver. And I got fired after my first day on the job. That day, and I will end, that day, I got an email that came into my server that said urgent substitute teachers are needed in Los Angeles charter schools. I had wanted to be a substitute teacher. I had taught illegally in China. I had taught kids illegally. I wasn't supposed to do it, and I did. And I got some good information from that. I love kids. Before I know it, I get on my knees. Dan says, "Surrender the outcome of this. Take this interview seriously and let God lead the way." And that's what has started to happen. I got hired. I was led to this job as a substitute in this school, this inner city school that had that incident of vandalism that I had alluded to, that I wanted to run to from. And God put me in the first grade. And now all this experience that I thought was going to be to become a rock star scholar has become channeled into the language of the heart and working with kids who I absolutely adore. And that's given me the structure and that sense of purpose, along with sponsoring beautiful men. Thank you for your time tonight. I have absolutely loved being with here. We could talk more about this for a long time, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being with Sharon on this road. I love growing with you, and I love growing with you guys. Thank you so much.
Let's give him another round of applause.